spring floods, fall floods.
There's extreme fires, extreme drought.
Extreme weather cost American farmers over $21 billion in 2023.
Our farm is more resilient through the use of cover crops.
These USDA climate programs are good for Main Street America.
Conservation practices that help farmers weather these storms are at risk in the Farm Bill.
If you're smart farming, you're also climate smart farming.
Climate smart farming is just smart farming. Learn more at investinourland.org. Paid for by Invest in Our Land.
Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, November 9th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We are going to spend a big chunk of our episode this week breaking down the big election results from this Tuesday. Democrat Ralph Northam, the lieutenant governor, won a big, big victory in the Virginia governor's race, defeating Republican Ed Gillespie by about 9 percentage points, a much bigger margin than anyone expected. And he brought a lot of Democrats with him up and down the ballot. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. It wasn't just Virginia either. There were local elections in New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, all sorts of places around the country where Democrats made some pretty shocking gains. And of course, they also gained a governorship in New Jersey, as long expected, with Governor Chris Christie retiring there, being replaced by Democrat Phil Murphy. We're going to break all that down and more. And we're also going to talk this week about tax reform. The House bill has been out for about a week now. We are going to have one of Politico's tax experts in the studio to talk about what's in the bill, what's causing some political tensions, and just how quickly this thing is going to be moving from here through the end of the year. Couple quick notes before we jump into that. Remember, email us your questions if you have them at nerdcast@politico.com. And remember to subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcast or your preferred podcast platform. All right, and we are starting off this week as usual with Senior Politics Editor Charlie Mattesian in the studio. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Scott.
We've got Campaign Pro reporter Kevin Robillard, who's been out on the trail covering the Virginia governor's race. Now mercifully over. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Scott. Great to be here.
And we have White House reporter Nancy Cook.
Hello.
All right. So we are going to start off talking about this week's biggest election. Our data point for the first segment is 8.9. And that is how many points Democrat Ralph Northam won by on Tuesday night in Virginia's gubernatorial race.
We are back by popular demand. Virginia, we have witnessed yet another Democratic sweep today.
A rout, pretty much, that far exceeded the polling average or most anyone's expectations on in either party. So, Kevin, start us off. Break it down. How did Northam win this one?
Northam won this race essentially by dominating Virginia's suburbs, especially the populous ones in Northern Virginia. The county that a lot of people are highlighting is Loudoun County, which is basically, people thought might be sort of the bellwether here that Gillespie had a chance to win it. Northam ended up winning it by about 20 points. I can tell you that I walked into Northam's victory party and informed his communications director that they had just won Loudoun County by 20 points, and his communications director immediately ran off to go celebrate. That might be a slight exaggeration of what happened, but yeah, the other county that you could really look at.
Why are they relying on you?
They did not think they weren't paying attention to the results that early because they were expecting this to be an extremely close race and for it to take a long time to get called. And it ended up getting called at about 8:15. It only took them about an hour and 15 minutes to call the race. The other county I would really look at is Chesterfield, which is a traditionally Republican leaning county outside of Richmond. Traditionally, it goes pretty heavy for Republicans. Gillespie won it actually by 0.3%, a very, very tiny margin, about a little under 300 votes when you break it down. And those two counties really tell the story of how Northam did this. He just absolutely racked up huge margins in the suburbs. He improved a little bit in some places in cities, really didn't improve at all in rural areas, actually did worse in some rural areas than Clinton did. But really, this was about the suburbs. It's really what made this margin grow.
That's really remarkable. And, you know, Gillespie, we talked about before, Gillespie ran for Senate in 2014 and nearly won. He only lost by about a point to Democrat Mark Warner, the incumbent. And he actually did better in more than 80 counties. He got a higher share of the vote on Tuesday than he did in 2014 in about 80 counties, despite the fact that he lost by 9 this time. And it really – it goes to show – but like you said, Kevin, he got crushed in Loudoun. He got crushed in Prince William. I think he lost by 23 points there. He lost by 37 in Fairfax, which is the biggest county in the state. Charlie, this goes back to a big – theme of yours, the suburban realignment in American politics.
Yeah, this is the story I wrote in June, which is that the Republican Party's post-war image has been that it's the party of the suburbs. And it's not just an image; it's the reality. They dominated the suburbs. The suburbs were the cornerstone of the modern Republican Party. But I think people have been slow to realize that the Republican Party is gone, and suburbia is no longer its wingman. And I think that's the result of a combination of demographic change and cultural dissonance that together have really eroded the Republican Party's ability to compete across much of suburbia. And so we have this new Republican Party that's important. It's different in one very important way than the Republican Party of the suburbs of, say, Ronald Reagan's era. Now, it's now a conservative party that rejects metropolitan values rather than a metropolitan party that embraces conservative values. And that is proving deadly in a lot of places. And Loudoun is a perfect example of this. So here's my Loudoun story, Kevin. So my little girl plays on a travel soccer team, and we played Loudoun recently, Loudoun County. And if you don't know where Loudoun County is, for folks that are outside D.C., it's, you know, maybe parts of it are maybe about an hour west of D.C. We went out there and got destroyed. And so I had a couple takeaways from that. The first one was I couldn't believe how big they were for 11-year-olds. They were awesome and just crushed us. But also what is lost, I think, in the discussion over what's happening in the suburbs is the diversity of the suburbs now. This is true in many suburbs, but it's particularly true in a place like Loudoun. The other thing that struck me about Loudoun, was, aside from how good they were, was how diverse their team was. And all of the suburbs that Northam dominated on Tuesday were highly diverse places.
And as long as I'm governor, I will make sure that we're inclusive, that we welcome people to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Our lights will be on. Our doors will be open.
And the discussion has been, well, how did these Republican places go so strongly for Northam? Well, they used to be Republican places, highly Republican places, but the GOP hasn't kept pace with the demographic change in these places, and they just cannot connect anymore. And whether it is Loudoun, whether it is Prince William, these were the big, booming suburban, exurban counties where Northam crushed Gillespie, or whether it's Henrico County or Chesterfield County, which are the Richmond suburbs where Republicans also did poorly. All of these places have diversified quite a bit in the last 20 years. There has been an influx in some of those counties of new Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans. I mean, these are not the places of 20 years ago, and they are, and as a result of the Republican Party's inability to reckon with these demographic changes and speak to these people, candidates like Ed Gillespie are losing by big margins.
Nancy?
So I have just a question for you two, because you follow these races more closely than I do. Was this just like on the substance of why Northam won and Gillespie lost? Was this a repudiation of the Trump presidency and people responding to that? Or was it sort of a discomfort with the way Gillespie positioned himself? I mean, he's really an establishment Republican. He was the head of the Republican National Committee at one point. He's been a lobbyist, but then he also kind of tried to play this populist, Trump playbook. So what was it? Was it like, you know, a reaction to the White House or reaction to Gillespie's, like the interesting way, new way in which he was trying to cast himself?
I think it's primarily a reaction to the White House with maybe a little bit of reacting to Gillespie on top of that. If you look at the exit polls, about 47% of the voters in Virginia strongly disapproved of President Trump. Northam won 95% of those voters. And about half of the voters there said Trump was a reason for their vote. 34% specifically told exit poll that they were voting to oppose Trump. That said, Democrats have certainly been insistent that Gillespie's campaign, which focused a lot on sanctuary cities and MS-13, backfired on him. MS-13, for those who don't know.
Confederate monuments.
Yeah,
also.
Confederate monuments. MS-13, for those who don't know, is an El Salvadoran gang that has some prominence in some of the Virginia suburbs. And so basically, if you look, it becomes pretty clear that Gillespie, slowly his negatives went up as he was airing those ads, whether that's because of those ads or because of Northam's attacks on him as a lobbyist and other attacks. It's hard to say. But really, I would say the primary thing has been this was a message to the Trump administration and to a secondary degree, a rejection of the way Gillespie ran his campaign.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that, that it was a referendum on the Trump administration and it was a repudiation of the Trump administration, because all of these places, all of these suburbs where Northam ran really well were beginning to show signs of unease with Donald Trump in November 2016. Trump either lost many of these places, raising lots of eyebrows, not just in Northern Virginia, but all places that were demographically similar across the country, whether you're talking about the Atlanta suburbs, Orange County, California. I mean, all of the suburbs showed this unease with him. And in many of them, if he didn't lose outright, he ran behind Ron these numbers. And I think this was just the latest manifestation of that discomfort with Trump. And I think the other reason that I'm convinced it was a repudiation of the Trump White House and in the way it's operating in the first year is, look at all the historic firsts that came out of this election. You saw an extremely diverse slate of individuals were elected across the country. And when I say historic first, whether you're talking about transgender candidates, of which there were several across the country, first time candidates, women candidates, African American first time mayors. I mean, you saw this again and again. A Sikh mayor in Hoboken, a Liberian refugee elected mayor in Helena, Montana. I mean, all of these places, I think that all of this support was galvanized by the first year of the Trump administration.
Yeah. And we're going to jump into that a lot more in the next segment. The thing that popped out to me about this is that there's been this question kind of circulating around politics and people preparing for the 2018 midterms for a while, what they believed the 2016 election results meant in terms of political alignment in local elections. You know, typically the presidential results are used as kind of a baseline for partisanship. But there was some questions earlier this year about the extent to which Trump was kind of a blip and an outlier or actually something that future election results were going to hew to, as we saw Obama, you know, the Obama margins in against Romney in a lot of places in 2012 really become what House and Senate elections hewed to in 2012 and 2014. I think the answer that we're starting to see in Virginia and elsewhere is that yes, like the Trump performance, especially in the suburbs, is the baseline at this point. And now there are the one caveat to that is that you've got – and Northern Virginia is a perfect example, because you have there a Republican congresswoman named Barbara Comstock who's representing a district that Gillespie just lost by 13. I think Trump lost by 10 in 2016. But she is one of those Republicans who's kind of – maybe not screaming at the top of their lungs, but kind of waving their arms above their head, Charlie, and telling the rest of the party that, hey, you know, I see the demographic change that's happening in these suburbs, and I'm working with these voters and trying to get out and meet them, and the rest of the party needs to catch up, or we're going to have a big problem.
Yeah, I think members of Congress, particularly the members in suburban districts, need to be very nervous. And I'm sure they're sweating bullets right now after seeing those results. And here I'm talking about not only Barbara Comstock in Northern Virginia, but Rodney Frelinghuysen in New Jersey. I think there are lots of districts that are going to come on line that haven't really been on the radar before, that have a suburban component to it, that are going to be in play largely because the suburbs are so uncomfortable with Donald Trump's style and agenda. And I think that is what's going to ultimately determine the outcome of the House. And I think my guess is, here's the thing. There were suburbs, lots of suburbs that weren't even talked about nationally that were really remarkable. Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, a place that used to be as conservative as it gets. Democrats made historic gains. Delaware County, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, historic Democratic gains. In New York, historic moments in Nassau County, which, as you guys know, as junkies, that is like the first modern Republican suburban machine. And that is a place presidents used to go on bended knee, to a place like Nassau County, the first real monster suburb. Democrats made historic gains there. So I think all of this will have Republican suburban members really scared after seeing numbers like the other night.
Well, one thing that I just thought was interesting is from the White House's perspective, you know, Gillespie was very careful on the trail to, like, never mention Trump, even if he was adopting some of his policies. And so Trump never campaigned for him there or did anything. But it was interesting because, you know, after Gillespie lost, Trump tweeted, as he often does, you know, basically he said, Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for. And, you know, this was Trump just trying to distance himself, even though I feel like this has, you know, huge implications for Republicans in 2018 and potentially huge implications for the presidency. If the Democrats took back the House, for instance, they would control the Oversight Committee and they could really make the White House's life quite miserable with investigations. But I think Trump, just as, you know, the leader of the Republican Party now, or just the de facto leader because he's in the White House, doesn't always necessarily understand or adhere to that role. And you see this here with this distancing.
That's a great point. One thing I want to jump into before we kind of move from the Virginia governor's race onto some of the other stuff that happened around the country. I want to talk about the polling. And the polling showed Northam narrowly ahead on average by the end of the race. And obviously, he ended up winning by a ton. It called the winner, but it was off by a lot. It was off by more than a lot of the cases where people thought it was really off in the 2016 elections. So what are we to make of that?
This was something I sort of struggled with as I was covering this race. One of the reasons, you know, Charlie put me on the spot a few weeks ago and I predicted a Northam win. One of the reasons I thought Northam was going to win was because if you go back to the primary, so many more people voted in the Democratic primary. That Tom Perriello, who lost the Democratic primary, received more votes that day than Gillespie did. So there were lots of signs of Democratic enthusiasm. If you went out to any of these events, Northam, despite, you know, Northam got knocked as a boring candidate a lot, and Gillespie also got knocked as a boring candidate, to be fair, Northam, which just consistently outdrew Gillespie, was getting crowds of about 150 people, and then Gillespie would come the next day or a week later and get 80. Stuff like that.
But isn't this the exact argument that Republicans made about Mitt Romney in 2012?
Yes, so this is the problem we're running into.
Right.
And the thing is, there were signs of Democratic enthusiasm that – so for instance, the Northam campaign in the final week, really the final weekend, saw a bit of a tick towards them. I believe their last tracking poll, they told me the raw data came out with them with an 8 or 9 point lead. And then they weighted it down just because they didn't believe that that was possible, that the electorate was going to be that Democratic. And they came out with about a 4 or 5 point lead. So they still felt good, but they didn't believe the electorate was going to be this Democratic either. And so when also your sources don't see this happening, it's very difficult to know how to cover a race, how to calibrate everyone's expectations.
I should say, since I'm getting laurels for writing about the suburban GOP's suburban collapse back in June, I should also fall on my sword and admit that I predicted a Gillespie win here on the Nerdcast on the same day that Kevin predicted a win. I just thought even though the Republicans are really struggling in the suburbs, I still thought he was going to run better than he did. But when it comes to the polling, some of the points Kevin was making, like, I do feel that there was more caution and humility when it came to the media's discussion and reporting on polling after the mishaps of recent years. I think that was reflected in the coverage of Virginia. I'd be curious to know whether all of you think the same, but I felt a real caution and humility in the body of work writing about polling. And, you know, ultimately it comes down to this. Polling is still, you know, as much an art as a science. You know, there are no guarantees with the polls. And the other point I'd make when we're talking about polling is, you know who did nail it? Quinnipiac. Mm-hmm. The Q poll nailed it after they've been taking much heat in recent years. And, you know, lots of Republicans have been disparaging it as a Democratic poll. And every time their numbers come out, you know, all across Twitter, there's this little brush fire about, oh, it's Q poll. It's a lefty Dem poll. Well, you know, they nailed it in both races this time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And when I say both races, I mean in New Jersey and Virginia and on the button, their last November 6th numbers were the exact margins in the races.
Right. Our second data point this week is the number 16, and that was the size of the majority that Virginia Republicans held in the State House of Delegates before Tuesday. And, you know, we're still waiting on some recounts in a handful of very close races. I think one of them was like 12 votes at this point or something. But it looks at this point like Democrats may have completely erased it. And we're talking about unexpected results. This is not something that was on anyone's radar before Tuesday. Even the most optimistic Democratic prognosticators were not were not expecting this. So, Charlie, put this in perspective, you know, for a national audience. 16 seats, possible control of the Virginia House of Delegates. I mean, what does that mean?
It is a shocking result, and that is not overstating it, largely because even the Democrats, even the most breathless partisan Democrat, would not have predicted gains like this. Nobody was talking on either side or even foresaw the possibility of the House changing hands. And so while lots of Democrats were really excited about making gains and figured they would make gains, nobody saw this. So that's really important. And it's also important in the context of a couple things. The context, number one, of the tremendous losses at the state legislative level that have occurred over the last 8 years. The Democratic Party essentially hollowed out during the Obama era because nobody was paying attention to what was happening in the state houses. Nobody cared. The party wasn't paying attention.
That includes voters.
Exactly.
Democratic voters.
And so Republicans have total control of a huge swath of the country. You know, when you're talking about the legislative level, so this was important for them to make gains, and also the prospect of winning back control of at least one of the chambers in Virginia was an important win for them. The other interesting thing I think about those numbers isn't just that it's the legislative gains. Those gains have come after a string of special election victories at the state legislative level across the country in some unlikely places where Democrats have upset Republicans and have built some momentum, all of which suggests when you put in Virginia with these isolated state legislative special elections that have been occurring since January, it goes to show that there is something in the Democratic bloodstream. There, you know, I wouldn't go so far yet as saying there's going to be a Democratic wave in 2018, but now you cannot rule it out. There is a real viable surge of electricity in that party, and it could lead to massive changes in 2018. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a wave, but it's out there now, and that energy is real and cannot be denied.
Yeah, a lot of time between now and then too. Two quick things about that I thought were interesting. There were some interesting kind of observations and lessons about gerrymandering in the Virginia result. So we saw the Democratic ticket essentially won by 9 points statewide, but we're still talking about the House of Delegates being near a tie, which gives you a sense of you know, how the lines are drawn there and how they were drawn back in 2011, 2012 by Virginia Republicans. On the flip side, though, we talk about how surprising a result this was. The thing about gerrymandering is that you're not the party that's drawing the lines is not trying to maximize their winning percentage in every district. They're trying to spread their votes as thinly as possible, basically. And when, you know, that can prevent district from changing hand maybe in kind of a normal year. But if there's a big wave, it's like a levee. And, you know, once you get over – once the water rises over the levee, it can wash a long way afterwards. And we saw that. You know, the 16 seats was remarkable. I mean, we'll see if it happens in the when the recounts are over. There were a few other – I mean, just going around the country, there were a few other interesting things last night. Nancy, you know, Maine had this ballot measure that expanded Medicaid there, which has been the subject of a huge local fight for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that's just what I was going to bring up. I mean, I feel like one of the things about these state legislatures, you know, partly it's about, you know, which party is going to gain control, but we're going to see really interesting policy things flow from that. I mean, you know, Virginia, for instance, hasn't been able to expand Medicaid. Now the margins in the state house there are much slimmer. And so that could be like potentially a game changer of the expansion of Medicaid in Virginia and the fact that it would put the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of it in sort of yet another state. In terms of Maine, this was an interesting case. They put it to voters whether or not they should expand Medicaid. Typically, it's been kind of governors that have decided it. And the voters said yes, which was kind of remarkable, you know. And so I think that will have very big implications, and it'll have implications all the way down to the Senate because, you know, Susan Collins, for instance, a senator, now sees that her constituents have gone out and voted to expand Medicaid. There is no way now that she's going to vote in the Senate for any Republican bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. And so, you know, there will be just all these interesting policy decisions. And that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg on that.
Okay, speaking of implications, I have to ask this question because I want somebody to answer this, and maybe somebody at this table can answer this. So I was looking at some spending figures, ad spending figures in the Virginia governor's race. Republicans overwhelmingly bought time on Big Bang Theory, and Democrats overwhelmingly bought time on NCIS. I don't watch either of those. So can someone explain that to me, like, or at least forward a theory? I'm serious.
I mean, so I will say.
Which one do you watch?
I don't watch either one. My parents love NCIS. I'll say that. I believe those are respectively I think those might be the two most popular shows on network television. So it sort of makes sense. But yeah,
are your parents lefties?
What?
Are your parents Democrats?
Split. One Republican, okay. One Democrat.
That's nice.
I honestly can't figure out what the, because I think my parents actually watch both of those shows, but NCIS is their show.
Law and Order makes sense to me. That's another one. That was the second most Democratic spending. I mean, because there you're hitting lots of women viewers there, and uh-huh. The Democrats naturally would want to reach lots of women viewers. But okay, how about Big Bang Theory? Nancy, you're a big fan, right?
I watch really trashy television. Like, I'm talking like, you know, I deal with tax policy all day and all this policy stuff. I watch like Real Housewives kind of stuff. Okay.
Well, speaking of Real Housewives, let's go up the coast to New Jersey. I mean, we've been in terms of.
Oh,
great transition.
I tried.
I distance myself from that.
We're talking about the policy implications of all these elections, right? We've got a Democratic governor in New Jersey, governor-elect in New Jersey now, Phil Murphy. That gives Democrats full control over state government there. There's going to be a lot of policy that they're going to try and push that Chris Christie has been blocking, a millionaire's tax, among other things. Go out west to Washington. Democrats took control of the state Senate by winning a special election there. That gives them full control of the Washington state government. And Democrats don't have full control of a lot of state governments, so this is a big deal for them. Again, kind of speaks to the breadth and depth of the election results on Tuesday night. Last question for this segment. What, you know, Republicans in Congress were watching all this. Do we think from a political perspective this makes tax reform more or less likely? Because I've been hearing both arguments. There are some people saying this shows that the Republicans need to get something done and have something to bring home to voters. And then there are other folks saying it's like, how, if you're a member in a suburban seat potentially facing a battleground race, how could you want to take another tough vote at this point to have to go home and explain?
As you all know, I love talking about tax reform, so I will weigh in first. I think that it means that there will be a tax bill that will pass, but I think it will be a package of temporary tax cuts, which I've always thought that this is where we would end up. You know, tax reform requires people to take super tough votes on getting rid of like a lot of deductions that some people like that affect people's mortgages or their ability to deduct interest on student loans or their ability to deduct interest on medical bills. And I just think that members are not in the headspace after this Virginia race to do that. And so I think it will just be, you know, wham, bam, easy. Everybody gets a tax cut. It will have to expire, you know, in 10 years to pass through the budget reconciliation. And Trump will get what he wants because, honestly, I don't think that he cares about the policy details of which deductions get eliminated. I think he just wants to be able to say, I gave everyone a tax cut in time for Christmas.
All right. Well, Kevin, last word.
So one thing I will note, Gillespie's signature economic proposal was an across-the-board income tax cut. And from what I can tell, it didn't move voters really at all. So I'm interested to see if this is actually the political tool Republicans think it will be for the 2018 elections. Gillespie started out basically his advertising exclusively focused on this tax plan. And then once that didn't move, voters really had to move to those social issues. So I think it's very – Virginia's a unique state in many ways. One of the ways it's unique is that it's – relatively wealthy, particularly the suburbs are. So maybe a tax cut isn't necessarily what they were looking for the way voters elsewhere might be.
Charlie, last word.
Yeah, I want to ask Nancy a question. Nancy, is it your sense that tax reform is going to – or it's not even tax reform. Tax cuts will happen because we're close right now, or is it because it's impossible to envision a scenario in which the Republicans – don't get it done because they're so petrified right now of going home to voters over Christmas with having failed on Obamacare and taxes?
Oh, I think it's the latter. I mean, they're not close at all. The House is still wrangling over its bill. The Senate is unveiling its bill today. They're totally different. Do you know what I mean? They're very far from sort of agreement on policy, although they may sort of ram it through quickly. But it's really because they're just petrified. You know, they've controlled Congress and the White House, and they want to show that they passed something through Congress.
Nancy, you have served up another excellent segue. We're going to talk about taxes in our next segment. First, let's bid farewell to Kevin Robillard, who is off to hibernate after time on the trail with the Virginia governor's race.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And for that third segment, we are going to welcome in Bernie Becker, who is the author of Politico's Morning Tax newsletter. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
Thank you for being here. So our data point to launch into this tax reform discussion is $1.574 trillion. And that is the current size, subject to change, of the House Republican tax bill, as lawmakers are this very second trading in and out provisions, trying to find an overall package that Republicans agree on. So this tax bill was introduced a week ago. It is being revised and updated as we speak. We're on the verge of seeing the Senate version, too, more or less as we speak. But that is the Nerdcast curse. Things happen on Thursday in Congress. We're just going to talk about what we know. Let's stick with the House. Bernie, can you tell us what's in the plan right now? What are the main points of this Republican tax plan, and what are the big changes that that would affect American taxpayers with?
Yeah, I think the central point, the central starting off point would be the House Republicans would cut the corporate rate from 35% to 20% permanently, immediately and permanently. This has been, you know, a so-called red line for the White House. This is the one thing President Trump has said that he has to have. And so that by itself costs around the $1.5 trillion, probably a little more, that Republicans have to spend. So you have to sort of build everything out from there. So anything else you want to put in, you have to find offsets for, which is sort of the large problem House Republicans have been facing. And sort of the other interesting things is that, you know, what we in the sort of nerdosphere care about is not always the things that the lawmakers themselves will care about. So one of the things that I don't think tax reporters particularly were concerned about beforehand was the deduction for medical expenses, the deduction for adoption costs, the ones for student loan interest. And those are the ones that have caught a lot of the lawmakers' concerns.
Huge political constituencies.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, the adoption one's really weird because it's piddling in the context of a big tax bill. It's about $3 billion over 10 years. But for social conservatives, it really is a deal breaker. So I don't see how that one lasts just because of the cost versus the actual cost versus the political cost of keeping it in. So that's been interesting to watch. I think the other big pieces here are, and this is particularly interesting for President Trump because he owns a lot of pass-through businesses, hundreds and hundreds. And that's a business where it's not a corporation like Apple or those sort of businesses. It's a business that sort of the taxes are paid through the individual system, through the owner's individual returns. We think Trump has hundreds of these. Mm. And so they would cut that rate down to 25%.
Is that also a permanent cut?
That is a permanent cut, yes. And so that's big. That could be very big for Trump. We don't know, obviously, because we don't have his tax returns. But it's the sort of the real want question there is that you're basically giving Donald Trump or lawyers or doctors or hedge fund executives this giant tax increase or tax decrease. So what you're trying to do then is sort of write rules to make sure that it's not abused. And that's sort of been a big issue for about a year now, because this has been one of the House GOP's big issues for a while.
One thing that I think is so interesting politically, and I honestly feel like this could be absolute political suicide for the Republicans if, like, this ends up being the case and people realize it, is that they would make the corporate rates permanent, but all of the, you know, benefits that would go to families, you know, like an expanded child tax credit, like all those things would be temporary, or they would sunset at some point. They would phase out. And I just feel like if people get their minds around that, particularly when the White House is trying to message this as like a middle class tax cut and something that's going to help everyday people, I just feel like, I mean, I've talked to Republican lobbyists about this who are like, I hope no one figures this out, because I just feel like it's going to be such a problem, because it just totally goes against Trump's right. populist message. It's like, here's your tax cut, Exxon. Here's your tax cut. Right. And like, oh, you're trying to adopt a child? No, no.
I think, what's fascinating there is so Republicans box themselves into this $1.5 trillion tax cut, which, I mean, on it, let's box themselves in. That's a big tax cut. And so what Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady, who's the chairman of the Ways and Means, has been saying is that this is a fake expiration. Like, we're not going to let this expire. If we get this bill in 5 years, you know,
We'll pass it again.
And this is not – so what they decided to do is they basically had to keep some things temporary to fit into this box. So they did the things that they thought would be universally popular – in 5 years from now and they thought would never expire, sort of exchanging that for the immediate political bad messaging, which is, oh, temporary tax cuts for families, permanent tax cuts for Exxon.
Well, and in some ways, like, you know, if history is a precedent, or at least recent history, mm-hmm. you know, they're right. I mean, the Bush tax cuts were extended. 98% of them, or something close to that figure, were made permanent in the year-end fiscal deal. What was that, in 2012?
2012, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, there is one precedent for it, but that also means, you know, it depends on who's going to control Congress mm-hmm. in 10 years and or even sooner than that. I think that's just a big gamble.
I agree, and I think that is the sort of – I think they're – confident enough, and this was done before Virginia, obviously, that they needed to pass something that they thought, you know, in, you know, 5-10 years, are we sure the other party will extend a 20% corporate rate? I mean, I think they think that there's a good chance they would, or at least a possibility, but do they feel pretty confident that they would extend, you know, credits for families? They feel pretty confident the other party would do that. Yeah.
One other political question I want to ask of you, Bernie, because you spend like a ton of time on the Hill, mm-hmm. and I don't really spend time up there anymore. You know, President Trump is gone in Asia. People I've talked to who are close to him are like, he's going to get off that plane and be like, where's my effing tax bill? Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's what I want it to look like. How do people on the Hill view him at this point as like a helpmeet on policy, but also as a salesman? It kind of seems to me like they're doing their own thing, but you would know better than I would.
I think, yeah. I mean, I think they're certainly – the fact that the House Republicans put this permanent 20% corporate rate in, that was a last-minute decision. And I think you talk to some of the members of the committee there, they'll tell you that, you know, that they were they were worried about the backlash if they didn't do that. We don't think the Senate's going to do that. We think the Senate will probably have to phase in their corporate rate. So
Bernie, the backlash from where? The White House?
Backlash from the White House. Right. Yeah, that they felt like, you know, they sort of bent over backwards to ensure that they could get that corporate rate permanently. And to be honest, I mean, I think Trump has been fairly he's been very big picture about this, right? I want there to be, you know, benefits for the middle class. But this one policy thing that he's wanted has been this 20% corporate rate. I mean, the irony there is that a lot of people don't think that will particularly help the middle class. But that's sort of the – and so he's put them in this box where they've had to sort of – he's had these two sort of perhaps conflicting things that he wants. And so I do think they've decided that this is something they have to write themselves. Their members have to pass it. They understand that there will be – pressure from the White House to we saw Mick Mulvaney say yesterday that, you know, if this isn't end up being a tax plan that helps the middle class, that Trump just won't sign it. I guess we'll have to see if that actually happens. But I think they realize the big picture that Trump wants and the messaging that he wants. And they've certainly tailored their messaging to that. But I think they've decided they've had to write the bill the way to sort of fit all these strange rules that they boxed themselves into.
What should we be looking for in terms of movement over the next, you know, what are the next big shoes to drop in this? Obviously, so there's the Senate plan coming out, but the way things are going right now, what do you expect to happen over the next days, weeks?
Okay, so next week, this was a big week. Next week, we expect the Senate Finance Committee to mark up their version, and the House is planning to pass their bill. So that would be
wow, a
able
vote
to
next
get the
week.
Bill. Yeah,
they've been so fast.
It's so fast.
So fast. They're,
I mean, We sort of text.
And we don't even know what the final
yes, and
bill
that's coming
like.
Today, Thursday. And so it doesn't give members a lot of time to really consider that. That's perhaps – it doesn't give lobbyists a ton of time to really do their work either. I think
that
that's part
wild.
Of what's part of what's at play here as well.
Well, and the idea, right, is that with tax reform, there's a well-funded lobbyist to fight against
everything.
Single thing yeah. that you would want to eliminate, right? And so if you move fast, you can prevent them from digging their hands in.
Right, and there's lawmakers with very parochial issues. We saw that with the New Jersey and New York Republicans in the House with the state and local deduction. But there's also like each district has sort of, you know, their own particular industries. Maybe there were some tax breaks that help those industries maybe gone. And so, you know, how quickly can they figure out that this is a bad deal? I mean,
we've seen in Utah, like the charitable deduction is a
right.
huge issue there because the Mormon Church gets
right.
such big donations, right?
Right. So and so that there's a lot of that. And I think, you know, it's interesting because they've done this sort of breakneck thing about, like, we have to get this done. I mean, Obamacare wasn't passed until March of 2010. It's not as if the calendar turned to 2018, like, immediately all legislation stops. But I do think they're sort of – they've seen how they get in their own way on healthcare, and sort of if there's any momentum, they just see no reason to stop. So we expect the Ways and Means Committee to pass their tax bill today. So why not move to the floor next week? The Senate's going to put their bill out today. Why not have finance work on it next week, pass it out, and then the week – they return from Thanksgiving, early December would be, I guess that's early December, maybe late November, that would be when it would hit the Senate floor, presumably.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, and then it gets into the point of, you know, these bills are going to look different. So will there be, there's going to be, will there be a conference? Will there be a stare down being like, this is the best we can pass, this is the best we can pass, take our bill, take our bill? I mean, that's, so there's still, I mean, even if both bills get out of both chambers, it's hard to see how that doesn't end up with some bill going to the president's desk. But even then, we won't exactly know, I think, how it would look.
Wow. A lot. That's a lot to process. And I mean, I'm stunned at how fast it's expected to happen. Although, as we've seen before with healthcare, right, just because they're planning to do it fast does not mean it's going to.
Right. I mean, and it's just sort of like the whole Virginia, New Jersey, like next year's midterms, that, you know, there's the question of whether this is the right tax bill to pass, but it does seem like they believe they have to pass a tax bill, that it's suicide otherwise.
Are they getting, like, pushback? Because I remember when the House bill came out, you know, Americans for Prosperity, mm-hmm. one of the Koch brothers groups, you know, there were certain things that they don't like there. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that I'll be interested to watch after the Senate bill officially comes out today and people have the House and Senate bills side by side is how groups react. You know, how does the business community react? How are lobbyists reacting? How are social conservatives reacting? I feel like the White House has tried to do quite a bit of outreach to all of these people. They've had them at the White House. Mostly it's just been like on messaging and kind of keeping them in the loop. But it'll be interesting to see if folks start to peel off.
Right.
And if that becomes like a louder sense of opposition, or if they are decide instead to really support these efforts and like put money behind it and resources.
Right. And so the other thing to remember there is that the Senate bill. So there's this Byrd rule we talked about for all or the health care bill as well. So the House bill doesn't meet the standard that the tax bill doesn't raise the debt in the out years. So the Senate bill will have to do that. And so you have to assume
that's
then
a procedural issue in the
thing, which said, I mean, there's various rules, but basically the big one for a tax bill is that it basically can't cut taxes, or it can't be cut taxes without offsets after year 10, starting in year 11. So the House bill does not do that. We're very confident of that. And the Senate bill would have to do that to be able to pass. And so that suggests that it would be not as generous as the House bill. And so then you've already seen some people have problems with the House bill, and you would think the Senate bill might be a little skimpier in some ways than the House bill. So,
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on that. We'll probably have to have you back real soon to.
You're going
to
become a regular, Bernie.
I know.
To talk through the implications as this thing rushes through. So, Bernie, thank you very much for being here today.
Of course.
Anytime. And Nancy, thank you for being here as always.
Oh, I love coming on. Thanks.
And Charlie, thank you.
Good to be back. Thanks.
And as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in this week. Remember, you can email us your questions at nerdcast@politico.com. And also, remember to subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. So once again, thank you to our panel for being here. Thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, our researcher, Zach Montalaro of Politico Playbook, and of course, as always, again, a big thank you to you, our listeners. Thanks for tuning in. We will talk to you again next week.